The market doesn't joke around, so why would you? Get serious. Choose Tastytrade. Tastytrade gives you the tools you need to make smarter moves. Dig into data with advanced charting, track profit accurately with order chain trackers, see risk clearly with curve analysis, and trade with low-capped commissions, stocks, options, futures, and more. All on one platform. No wonder serious traders choose Tastytrade. Join the club, genius. Tastytrade Inc. is a registered broker-dealer and member of FINRA and SIPC.
You're listening to The Exchange. Here's today's show.
Welcome, everybody, to The Exchange for a Friday. I'm Tyler Matheson, and I'm in for Kelly Evans. Here's what's ahead. Another day, another hotter-than-expected inflation read. The Fed's key PCE data showing that inflation ticked a little bit higher in March from the previous year, but it held steady from February. Stocks managing to shake that off with all three major averages higher at this hour. Yields, though, under a bit of pressure as market expectations for maybe two interest rate cuts this year rose a bit. Our economist isn't fully convinced, though, and says that while unlikely, some of the recent data does not necessarily take hikes off the table. He'll tell us why. And with costs still climbing, we've got three buys and a bail. Inflation Insulation Edition. Plus, we'll bring you the three names one trader says can weather the storm. And the one she's staying away from, despite climbing nearly 17% this week after earnings. Plus, deal with it. That's the message from China's Xi to Secretary of State Antony Blinken during his visit over there. The Chinese president saying in order for bilateral relations between the two countries to improve, the U.S. needs to look at China's development in a, quote, positive light. A lot to get through today, but let's start with the market action and Dom Chu.
Very much the Taylor Swift shake it off market today, because we have seen now session highs at this point in just the last couple of moments or so. The Dow Industrial's up to 38,302. That's good for a 215-point gain, roughly 0.5% to the upside there. The S&P 500 is at 5109, up about 60 points. We were up roughly 64 points at the highs we just saw maybe in the last 2 to 3 minutes. We were still up 25 points at the lows of the session so far. Now, we were at 5109 for the S&P. The level that some traders are watching is 5125. That is on the upside for the 50-day average price on a rolling basis, that so-called simple moving average. So keep an eye on that level. The NASDAQ composite pacing the advance. Big tech, a big part of that story. Up 2.25%, 350 points to the upside for the composite index, 15,961. I'm going to show you now a slate of stocks, including the reasons why that tech trade is so phenomenal. Alphabet shares on the heels of earnings right now, you can see up about 10%. Goldman Sachs on the financials up 1.5%. Chipotle's up 2.25%. Tractor Supply on the consumer side of things, and Colgate-Palmolive on staples, all up anywhere 1.5% to 10% upside for Alphabet. All of these, and I'm going to draw them because some folks do enjoy seeing these stars come up here. All five of these stocks at one point today set record intraday highs. So keep an eye on that big trade, especially in technology. And then the rates picture has been very volatile this week, given some of the inflation data, eco data overall. Check out the 10-year note, though, yield on a one-week basis. A very fractional move here, but we started off the week just at a hair below 4.65, and we are not far from there right now, about a 4.67%. So despite the roller coaster ride that we've seen, Tyler, those 10-year note yields and that inflation proxy and everything else that goes into it is relatively stable at the beginning of this week versus the end of it. We'll see if that sticks. I'll send things back over to you, Tyler.
Yeah, virtually where it began. Thanks very much, Dom. Sticky inflation forcing the market to dial back expectations of rate cuts this year. Our next two guests scaled back their expectations too, seeing just one cut in the cards likely, and likely toward the end of the year. But one of them says more cuts are needed. Joining us now, Mark Giannone, chief U.S. economist at Barclays. Vahan Janjigian, he's chief investment officer at Greenwich Wealth Management. And CNBC senior economics reporter Steve Leisman joins us as well. Steve, let me begin with you. Take us through this morning's numbers. Tell us why they are the favored measure of the Fed and why I feel as though some of the momentum in the reduction of inflation has been quelled. We don't have as much momentum.
Yeah, I think you're right to feel that way, Tyler. And it is really backed up by the data. The Fed follows the PC because it thinks it's a better gauge of overall inflation in the economy. It de-emphasizes housing, has a little bit more medical care in it. Some other shifts in it that make it, they feel, a better gauge of the economy. We could have an argument over it. Some people like the CPI better. What happened this morning is we dodged a bit of a bullet. It wasn't as bad as it could have been. What we learned this morning, we knew yesterday that the quarterly inflation number was higher than had been expected. We wanted to know this morning when it was higher, and we learned it was more in January than it was in March. And so it's a little bit more in the rearview mirror. It's a little bit more where we thought we had an outside inflation number, which was in the January turn of the year data that we had, a little bit less, just a touch in February, and not much more in March. Look, just because it wasn't as bad as it could have been doesn't mean it's good. You're right. Momentum has slowed when it comes to inflation. The headline ticked up. The core went sideways. And so that momentum has stalled. And all of this means the Fed has less confidence with which to cut rates. July, not really happening. September now is really the only place where we're over 50% on those probabilities, Tyler.
Vahan, I'd like you to respond to what Steve said and sort of my initial question. I note in my notes, it says, my view is that the preponderance of evidence indicates that inflation remains on a downward trend. Tell me about that preponderance of evidence and why I feel as though that downward trend has kind of stalled.
Well, you would expect the downward trend to stall as you reach the target. We've come down a lot from the peak, and we do expect the decreases in inflation to stall as you get closer to that 2% target. And because monetary policy works with a lag, I do believe that the Fed should start decreasing rates. Now, you know, I do expect that they will decrease rates this year, probably only once. But I think higher rate cuts are called for. And I think the bond market is already telling us that. I mean, today, the bond market's actually, the yields are down despite this evidence that maybe inflation did not come down as much as we had hoped. Furthermore, I'm very concerned about the national debt and the cost of servicing that debt. And even though I know it's not in the Fed's mandate, I think there will be growing pressure on the Fed to start decreasing rates so that the government can roll over some of this debt at shorter yields. And if they reduce that Fed funds rate, I do not expect longer term rates to go down. I expect them to remain at about the same levels, maybe even closer to 5%. But I would say that would be a good thing because it will make the yield curve normalize and become upward sloping again.
Right. Before I turn to you, Mark, let me just follow up on something, Vahan, you just mentioned. And that is one of the reasons, if I'm understanding it, that you believe that the Fed should cut rates and should do it in a series. In other words, more than just one over the next, let's say, year or so, is because you are concerned about the amount of debt service cash that the federal government has to pay at these higher rates to service the federal debt. You lower those rates, the debt service comes down, and that frees up more money for other things like defense or human health and other things.
Well, you're correct that I'm concerned about that. However, the Fed is probably going to ignore that because, as I said, that's not in their mandate. They're going to say, let the government reduce the debt, do it on the fiscal side rather than the monetary side. But I think the Fed will face pressure to do something.
Yeah. All right. Mark, let me turn to you and get your view on interest rates and the numbers that came out today. You're in the probable rate cut camp, but have recently said and sort of reiterated just a few hours ago the idea that, well, there's a long shot possibility maybe that they would even raise interest rates, though that is not your base case.
Yeah, thanks, Tyler. Thanks for having me. It's not our base case. Our base case is for the Fed to cut rates once this year. We think that given the recent evolution of inflation, the reacceleration of inflation, indeed, that we got in the first quarter, and the still strong prints that we saw even in March, we think that we are on a trend down on inflation. It's gradually going to come down later in the year. And in that case, the Fed will be allowed to or will be able to cut rates. But we don't think it will be able to do that more than once this year.
What are you seeing, Mark, in terms of the economy? We had a GDP number yesterday that some people were disappointed by. Where are you on the current health of the U.S. and the global economy, for that matter?
Right. So we think the health of the U.S. economy is still very good. The overall economic activity is still strong. It's true that GDP yesterday printed lower than expectations by quite a margin, actually, with the 1.6% growth rate. But the underlying demand is still very strong. A lot of that weakness came was reflecting in strong imports, was reflecting in destocking, so lower inventory contributions. And so we think that if you look at the overall demand, it's still pretty strong. And in fact, it hasn't changed much from the pace we have seen in the third and fourth quarter of last year, where we had remarkably strong growth. This, together with the monthly profile of consumption that we got this morning, tells us that there is still quite a bit of momentum as we go into Q2. So we think that there is some support here on consumption in the second quarter. For the outlook further down, we see some gradual slowing and returning basically back to trend growth towards the end of this year, but still a pretty resilient economy until then.
Steve, why don't you just react to what you've just heard? And I guess one of the questions I would have is why on a day when inflation came in a little tiny, maybe a bit hotter than expected, would yields decline, as Vahan pointed out?
Well, I mean, first of all, yields have come a long way in the past month or so. So there's plenty of room for them to come down. They overshoot. I think it's because of what I was saying earlier, Tyler, because I think the market was braced for the possibility that extra inflation could have shown up in March. And while Vahan is right and Mark is right, we did have a higher number in March than we would have liked. It was still not the number. I went into the numbers, Tyler, with a very simple metric in my mind. Mm-hmm. 0.3 was good, and 0.4 was bad, and it came in at 0.3. So that was okay. I am really interested, though, in what economists and forecasters are doing for the second quarter. We're going to report our Fed survey data on Monday, but I am seeing some numbers, Tyler, if you can believe it, north of 3%. It may be because of what was just discussed. We've had two quarters of inventory drawdown. We might have an inventory build. We had a big negative shock when it came to terms of trade. It was minus 9.9%. So almost a full percentage point. That may be something that comes back. But I'm seeing numbers. I think Goldman just put out their tracking forecast at 3.5. Mm-hmm. Atlanta Fed just started GDP now at 3.9%. So I get what Mark is saying about, hey, this weakness has to come eventually. But at least in the initial drawing of the second quarter outlook here, I'm not seeing much weakness, and I didn't see much economic weakness in the first quarter either.
Vahan, let me give you the last word and let you put on your chief investment officer hat and talk about a couple of the areas you like: financials, biotech, IBM, and Verizon.
Yeah, okay. So first of all, I would say I agree with what Steve just said. I do expect second quarter GDP growth to be much better. And as Mark pointed out, one of the reasons we saw a weak number recently was because of those net exports. But yes, I have been taking advantage of what's been going on in the market. One thing I've been doing is buying a lot of T-bills. I continue to buy short-term T-bills and roll them over because I believe the Fed is giving us a gift by keeping rates this high, even though I believe rates shouldn't be that high. But I'm taking advantage of that with excess cash that I don't have a strong conviction for. But I'm also taking advantage of sell-offs in the market, and I have put some money to work in a couple of ETFs, the XLF, which is the financial ETFs, and the XBI, which tracks biotech companies. I do like IBM and Verizon, and I would point out that these are two stocks that are very much like bonds. They pay very generous dividends, but unlike bonds, those dividends grow over time. Both companies have been increasing their dividends every year for a long period of time. And even though you haven't seen much of it, they do give you the opportunity of getting some capital gains over a long run.
Vahan, thank you very much. Have a great weekend. Vahan Janjigian and Mark Giannone, Steve Leisman as well. Have a great weekend, fellas. All right, let's turn now to technology. Alphabet and Microsoft shares popping after both companies beat on the top and bottom lines. One of the reasons why the Nasdaq is as hot as it is, the tech giants emphasizing the growth of their respective AI businesses. But that does come at a big cost. Microsoft's CapEx jumped 79% in the third quarter compared with the previous year. Steve Kovac joins us now with more in today's Tech Check.
Yeah,
Steve.
And we're talking about the monetization stories these two companies are telling about artificial intelligence, Tyler. And it's clear what we heard yesterday. It's the very early days, not a lot of disclosure on what's working, just some promising nuggets of information showing both companies could be on the cusp of something big here. For Microsoft, we saw the AI sales show up in the Azure Cloud unit. It contributed 7 percentage points of the overall 31% year-over-year revenue growth. That's up from 6% quarter over quarter. But that's where the AI monetization story kind of ends at Microsoft. There was lots of mushy talk from CEO Satya Nadella on Copilot, but at the end of the day, we really have no idea how well it's selling. Nadella did throw us something here and said a handful of companies we're showing you right now that bought at least 10,000 subscriptions for Copilot. As for Google and Alphabet, CEO Sundar Pichai shot back at the idea Google's core search business was under threat from chatbot search engines like the one from startup Perplexity. He said tests showed increased usage in AI search. If that pans out, that's, of course, more chances to stuff in ads. And beyond advertising, Pichai said Google will monetize AI through subscriptions and cloud, just like Microsoft's doing already. One other interesting argument, not related to AI necessarily, from Pichai, he said YouTube and Google Cloud combined will have a $100 billion run rate this year. His way of saying Alphabet's more than just selling search ads.
What do I get if I subscribe to one of these AI services? What is the one from Microsoft? You mentioned it.
Microsoft is Copilot.
Copilot, yeah. And Google's own one.
It depends on who you are. So there are consumer versions that just regular people can sign up for on an individual basis.
For free or for pay?
There's a free version. There's a paid version. $20 a month. It gives you the latest and greatest models. By the way, OpenAI has a very similar product that it offers by itself. And that is also what Google's trying to do with Gemini, offer these subscriptions. Then on the enterprise level, that's where the real money is, right?
Yeah.
Big businesses coming in.
Hundreds of people. Thousands of
people. Like I just showed you, there's that wall of companies buying at least 10,000. Multiply that 10,000 by $30 per month. Boom, you see how much money potentially Microsoft can make. That's why there's so much enormous interest around how well Copilot is selling.
All right, Steve, thanks very much. Steve Kovac. Coming up, China warning the U.S. of a downward spiral as Secretary of State Anthony Blinken meets with China's President Xi. The tone of this trip is very different than Janet Yellen's. We've got the details and what's at stake next. Plus, higher for longer has led banks to pull back on lending and non-bank lenders are stepping in. They are increasingly teaming up now. We'll talk to one CEO with a front row seat on it all. The exchange returns after this. All right, welcome back to the exchange. Secretary of State Anthony Blinken meeting with President Xi Jinping today of China, final day of the visit there. Secretary Blinken stressed the need to avoid miscalculations and misunderstandings, while President Xi brought up the importance of China's economic growth and stressing that the way China grows matters. This is the U.S. and China are walking a fine line between cooperation and competition as disputes grow over trade, national security, geopolitics. So let's bring in our panel of experts to discuss where things stand and where they might go from here. Joining us now, DeWardwick McNeil, Managing Director and Senior Policy Analyst, Longview Global, and Nicholas Lardy is a Senior Fellow at the Peterson Institute for International Economics. Nicholas, or Nick, may I call you? Welcome. Welcome to both of you, by the way. But Nick, let me start with you. It seems as though the U.S. is trying very hard to thread a needle between actions that are meant to be corrective or encouraging or punitive and language that is meant to be conciliatory. Can they do that?
Well, I think so far the administration has been able to do that. They're very tough on the economic front, tighter and tighter sanctions, more and more tariffs. But they're getting the meetings between President Xi and President Blinken. The Secretary of the Treasury and others from the administration have met their counterparts in Beijing. So the geopolitical atmosphere has improved a bit. But at the same time, the administration is announcing tighter and tighter restrictions on the economic and technical exchange with China.
What does it tell you that that China has been receptive, as you say, to meetings with Secretary Yellen, Secretary Raimondo, now Secretary Blinken? What does it tell you that they're trying to do here?
Well, I think they want to have a stable relationship with the U.S., and they're hoping they can get some modification in the U.S. Economic policy towards China. I don't think they're going to have much luck, at least in the short term. I think the administration is pretty hard over on restricting China's economic growth and access to technology.
DeWardwick, one of the issues that was discussed here, apparently, during the conversations, is Chinese aid to Russia that would be potentially lethal aid that could go to Russia in its war against Ukraine. Do you sense any progress on this front?
We'll have to see, Tyler. As you say in the opening here, this is the major part of Blinken's visit here, is to deliver a tough message on Russia. You'll recall that at the beginning of this conflict, the U.S. was very clear that lethal aid to Russia could trigger secondary sanctions. And for the last 2 years, China has not delivered anything that's easily identifiable as lethal aid. But what we have seen is China sending to Russia things like microelectronics, machine tools that helps them to backfill their defense industrial base. But the U.S. is growing increasingly concerned that it is helping Russia on the battlefield in Ukraine. So Blinken was there to deliver a tough message that either get this together or there will be some additional sanctions that's going to be brought to the fore, particularly here, Tyler, potentially on Chinese banks, which could breed all sorts of chaos into the market.
So, Nick, let me pose sort of a college essay question to you. Compare and contrast this visit of Secretary Blinken with that of Secretary Yellen a few weeks ago.
Well, I think there are a lot of similarities. Secretary Yellen was asking for some adjustments in Chinese industrial policy, talking about overcapacity in certain industries that was leading to large exports, which potentially would be adverse for the United States. Blinken is also conveying a message that's asking China to change its policy, just like Secretary Yellen, in this case, restricting a broader range of exports to Russia. China has not violated any official sanctions, but the U.S. is raising the ante, saying that even normal trade has to be more restrictive because it might indirectly contribute to Russia's war-making capability. As we've already noted, China has not sold any military equipment, direct military equipment to Russia, but now we're asking them to tighten up even more.
DeWardwick, how big a danger is the relationship? How much danger is embedded in the U.S.-China relationship? Specifically, we worry with a lot of talk about pressure in the South China Sea, pressure against Taiwan. How dangerous is this relationship these days? Or is it a little less dangerous than it was 2 years ago, 4 years ago?
It's a good question, Tyler. Let me try and answer it this way. I think it is more managed than it was a year ago, but the dangers and the risks that things can go bad are still there. But listen, I think the administration has to be given a lot of credit here, because what you're seeing with the Yellen trip, what you're seeing with the Blinken trip, is this attempt to really put in place this managed approach. And so you have a situation where high-level dialogue is taking place on real issues of concern on both sides, and a real clear expression of the consequences that may come if these things are not addressed. And I think that is the essence of what a managed relationship will look like. It's not going to take out the risk necessarily, but at least we are talking, and the consequences on both sides are being made very, very clear here.
So, Nick, let me I have a hard time phrasing this with nuance. So I'm just going to say it. I'm just going to blurt it out. Has the Biden administration's approach to China, i.e. keeping tariffs in place, fundamentally thereby embraced, endorsed, or shown that Trump got it right when he put those tariffs on?
Well, I think you're absolutely right. A lot of people early on thought Biden might back off a little bit on the tariffs and undo some of the things that Trump put into place. But he's done exactly the opposite. He hasn't taken away any of the tariffs that Trump put in, and he's added a lot more, and he's added a great deal more in terms of technology restrictions. So he has basically doubled down on the Trump restrictions. And of course, it's been very popular with both parties. So I don't think it's likely to change anytime soon.
Warwick, do you agree with that, that Biden's actions have implicitly said Trump got it right?
Well, I think if you talk to the administration, what they would say is that what they have tried to do differently is really bring allies and partners into this, reduce some of the tariffs that were being placed on allies and partners. But on balance, I agree with Professor Lardy here. I think the approach here using tariffs to try and change the behavior of China has remained in place.
Nick Lardy, thank you very much. Warwick McNeil, thank you very much. Have a great weekend, gentlemen. Appreciate your time today. We'd like to see you again soon. All righty, coming up, a special three buys and a bail addition to hedge inflation, including this name that our trader says gets going when the going gets tough, and she's a buyer. But first, it's time for Sectornomics. We're going to look at financials, but pulling out a few non-bank names here. And because we like mystery charts, here's another one. This name has been a big outperformer this year. We'll tell you which one it is and the other names like it to watch. We'll be right back. Welcome back to The Exchange, everybody. Financials, one of the best performing sectors in 2024 so far, but it's not the banks seeing outsized gains this year. Dom Chu joins us now with that story. Hey, Dom.
Oh, so it's vying financials, to your point, Tyler, with technology as one of the best performing, in fact, the third best performing sector of the S&P 500 so far this year. Neck and neck race right now between tech and financials. Now, if you look over the past year, it's up roughly 27%. And since the November lows, it's almost been a straight line higher, but for over the course of the last couple of weeks or so. Now, you talked about the idea that it's not just about the banks in financials. Check out the most heavily weighted stocks in the index overall. You look at names like, yes, we know, JP Morgan Chase, Wells Fargo, Amex, Goldman Sachs, but look at the other ones that are up there. Berkshire Hathaway, Visa, and MasterCard drive a lot of the action going on there. And specifically, check out some of these top performers over the course of the past year-to-date period, because three stocks in particular are among the best performers. Each of these up more than 20% just so far in the first part of the year. Check out Progressive, Allstate, and Hartford. What do they all have in common? Maybe it goes without saying. They're all in insurance, and they're among the best performing S&P 500 financial stocks. So keep an eye on those insurance companies. It's not just about the banks in the financials, Ty. I'll send things back over to you.
Very interesting. Dom Chu, thank you very much. Pippa Stevens now with the CNBC News Update. Hey, Pippa.
Hey, Tyler. Former President Trump's lawyers finished their cross-examination of former National Enquirer publisher David Pecker this afternoon. On redirect by prosecutors, Pecker confirmed that he bought the story of former playmate Karen McDougal alleging an affair with Trump to influence the 2016 election. He added that the purpose was to acquire lifetime rights so no other news organization should publish it. 21 million people are at risk for severe storms across the Midwest, from Iowa to Texas. The storms are forecasted to bring large hail, flooding, and possible tornadoes. In Oklahoma, storms already caused damage this morning, with a tornado watch in effect. The worst of the storms is expected to continue into Saturday. And China launched its Shenzhou 18 spacecraft to send three astronauts to replace a crew who has been on the country's space station since October. It's part of China's plan to put astronauts on the moon by 2030. The mission is the country's 13th to space. Tyler, back to you.
Pippa, thank you very much. And coming up on The Exchange, as banks limit lending amid higher for longer, could private credit be in a sweet spot for longer? We'll talk to one player who says private credit will be the place to be for commercial real estate. The CEO of Peachtree Group will join us ahead to make his case. Plus, despite today's bounce back, investors getting rocked to their core lately. PCE can't seem to cool, and especially after yesterday's data-driven sell-off, investors may want to find a little insulation from inflation. The Exchange is back in 2 minutes.
How about Cap'n Crunch's Crunch Berries with breakfast?
Whoa, Dad, we're on
Crunch Island. He's John LaFoot.
And He stole our crunch!
Quick, the zip line!
He's getting away!
Throw our last crunch berry!
No!
No one steals my crunch berries!
I think you mean my crunch berries. Choose your own crunch venture with Cap'n Crunch!
What's on the horizon for financial markets? At PGIM, it's a question that over 1,400 investment professionals relentlessly research in pursuit of your long-term goals. Specialized across asset classes, but united in collaboration, our teams provide global and local expertise. Our investments shape tomorrow, today. Pursue your tomorrow with PGIM, a leading global asset manager.
Welcome back to The Exchange, everybody. Higher interest rates and regulatory pressures keeping traditional lenders on the sidelines more and more when it comes to commercial real estate. But our next guest says this is providing a huge opportunity for private credit, especially as rate cut expectations fade just a bit. Greg Friedman is CEO of Peachtree Group, a private equity firm that invests in and lends to commercial real estate. Greg, welcome. Good to have you with us.
Yeah, thank you, Tyler.
So let me understand, you have really two businesses, a private equity business where you own commercial real estate, among other businesses, and then a private credit business where you are lending mostly to whom? To commercial real estate developers?
That's correct. So we're typically lending to like developers, regional ownership groups that own, you know, just commercial real estate across the U.S.
So they need money because, in part, as I understand it, the traditional lending sources have been restricted either by regulation or capital so that they don't have the money to lend. Am I right on that?
That's right. Like, so if you look at
the commercial real estate, you're exploiting a gap in the
financing market.
In the financing market, yeah.
Exactly. Because the commercial, you know, if you look at the commercial real estate lending market, banks make up 50% of the commercial real estate lending market today. Unfortunately, you know, banks are broken today. They have a lot of regulatory pressure. They're not able to lend at the same levels that they once were able to lend at. And most of the, you know, the loans for commercial real estate is coming from the regional banks that have been under, you know, heavy pressure. And that's opening up a gap for us to fill, to step in and provide those loans. And in a lot of cases, we're partnering with banks and helping to convert their commercial real estate exposure into C&I exposure to help limit that.
So you not only would lend to a borrower, but would you buy loans from a bank?
We would, and we do buy loans. This year alone, we've already bought, you know, close to $250 million of loans since the end of last year to till now. You know, as a firm, we've bought over 250 first mortgage loans. We bought a bunch of loans during the pandemic, as well as during the great financial crisis. And, you know, we've bought over, you know, a dozen loans in the last, you know, 5 months.
So as you look as a lender, as a private equity company, at all of the opportunities that might come across your desk in commercial real estate, tell me where the strong points are and where the weak points are. When you get an application for a loan from a data center, you go check, boom, bang, great.
Right.
They're going to make money.
Right.
Some other kind of industrial commercial real estate, check, great, wonderful. Commercial retail development. I got to look at that one a little hard. Office. Ooh, I got to look at that one even harder. Segment it out for me.
Yeah, sure. So, you know, because commercial real estate is, you know, it's a huge industry, you know, when you look at it, and there's different segments. Obviously, office is going through a lot of secular distress. We're not as bullish on the office segment. But as we're looking across the different, you know, segments of commercial real estate, like multifamily, hotels, industrial, you know, we're looking at making loans typically to projects that are going through some type of transition. So these are, you know, experienced operators, developers, owners of assets, where we're looking to provide, you know, financing so that we can help them, you know, bridge from, you know, taking, you know, if it's a construction loan, if it's an acquisition loan, where they're going to, you know, basically improve the performance of that asset and then turn around once they stabilize it, they're going to take us out with permanent debt. And that's typically what's in a typical market. Now, today, just given how, you know, bad, you know, the credit markets are and how soft, you know, there's not as many lenders as there once were. In a lot of cases, we're providing that bridge capital to allow for when a loan's maturing, because you have this wall of debt maturity right now. You have, you know, over $1 trillion of loans maturing between now and the next 12 months. In a lot of cases, borrowers are not able to find another bank or find a traditional permanent lender to take out that loan maturity. So we're stepping in and providing that capital to bridge them for the next couple of years until the market's normalized.
If I've heard a data center mentioned once this week on CNBC, I've heard it 100 times.
Right.
Tell, Tell me about what you're seeing in that particular area and what the buzz is around data centers and your business and how involved you are in financing, lending to.
Sure. So within data centers, we're not that heavily involved. Mm-hmm. So we're not, I mean, our traditional, like if you look at the type of, you know, projects we're financing, it's primarily multifamily, industrial, you know, self-storage, hotels. We don't do a lot in data centers, but data centers, you know, it's a big industry and it's obviously, you know, benefiting from the AI boom and everything else that's happening right now.
I have to just observe that I think America must be the only country that has created multiple billionaires based on the fact that we have too much junk.
Right.
And we need storage units to,
sure,
to store all this stuff. I want to ask you, your company began basically in the hotel world, or that was a big part of the core of your business for a long time. Tell me how hotels are doing right now.
Yeah, so hotels are performing well for the most part. They've recovered extremely well from the, you know, pandemic. Obviously, it was the hardest hit property type. It's in most cases, hotels are back or above pre-pandemic levels. And the hotel industry really benefits from the fact that there's just a lack of new supply coming in our industry because of the impact of COVID, as well as just the impact of the, you know, credit markets, where it's hard to get a construction loan today. So demand's way outpacing any new supply getting delivered. So the fundamentals are really strong across the lodging space today.
All right, great. Thanks very much. Continued good fortune to you.
Thank you. I appreciate it, Tyler.
Thank you so much.
Yeah.
All right, Peachtree Group, Greg Friedman. All right, coming up, Intel sinking on lower than expected revenue forecast. The stock now on pace for its worst month since 2002. Somebody picked it in the stock draft yesterday. I think it was Austin Eckler. We'll hear from the CEO, Pat Gelsinger, next.
From pit lane to podium, the Las Vegas Grand Prix is providing fans a race day experience at the speed they deserve. With the help of T-Mobile for Business, our 5G advanced network solutions are powering race day operations with event-wide connectivity. From streamlined gate entry to an immersive app, giving fans blazing fast access to the sport they love. This is accelerating innovation. This is the Las Vegas Grand Prix with T-Mobile for Business. Take your business further at T-Mobile.com/now.
Welcome back to The Exchange, everybody. Time now for a little show and tell, where we show you the chart and tell you the story. Intel lower on a revenue miss. Disappointing second quarter guidance. Management expects a recovery in the second half, by the way, thanks in part to the PC refresh. And that's not the only thing that will drive demand. Intel CEO Pat Gelsinger sat down with John Fort and addressed how Intel is meeting AI demand.
Overall, our view is that, you know, the story for the last several quarters has clearly been the Gen AI and the accelerator story, you know, largely becoming the consumer of budgets and the focus and power, so on. We're seeing a more normal cycle as we look forward, and we have gotten all of those signals from our partners and channel partners as well. And, you know, so we see some recovery in that business. We saw that in the first quarter already. And for us, our story is also one of an improving product line. And with our Sierra Forest and Granite Rapids, we have a better product that's more power, performance, competitive. So it's also the opportunity to stabilize and regain share as well as part of our unique opportunity.
All right, folks, still to come. Today's three buys and a bail. Our trader shares names she thinks can withstand the heat of red hot inflation and one that she says cannot. The Exchange will be right back. Welcome back, everybody. The Fed's preferred inflation gauge rising slightly more than expected last month. But worry not. We've got three names that will be just fine and one that might not be in a special three buys and a bail inflation insulation edition. And here with those picks is Gina Sanchez, Lido Advisors, Chief Market Strategist. Hi, Gina. How are you?
I'm good. How are you?
Why don't we start with Eli Lilly? Shares on pace to snap a three-month win streak. Deutsche watching demand for Zepbound and Mounjaro, looking down the pipeline for potential Alzheimer's and heart failure treatments. Are they going to keep paying for these weight loss drugs, Gina?
Well, so what's interesting about that is that tirzepatide, which is the underlying medicine behind both of those drugs, just went through a phase two trials to prove efficacy for sleep apnea. The reason that's a big deal is because sleep apnea opens up Part D insurance coverage. And one of the biggest challenges people have had has been getting access to insurance coverage for these very expensive weight loss drugs. And this could be a real game changer.
This could be a game changer, so I assume you like this. This would be in your buy. But there are people who believe that truly these drugs, the GC1 or whatever they're called, Zepbound, Mounjaro, and all this, could literally break the bank of the United States.
You know, I think that there's so there's some truth to that. I do think that the pricing is extraordinary, and the GLP-1 agonists and GIP agonists, which is the sort of that's the hormone that they're effectively replicating. They have incredible benefits. The question is, do those benefits offset in terms of other costs down the road by reducing diabetes, by reducing heart disease, and other you know problems that come with obesity? Will that pay for itself in the long run? And there are some skeptics out there for sure, but the reality is that the demand is there.
Really
the demand
good, really is absolutely good point. There. In other words, does the cost get offset by the savings that might come by the improvements in health that you might see from these drugs? And thank you for bailing me out on the GLP? GLP-1, all right.
GLP-1 agonists.
All right, you got, boy, I love when you say that. All right, next up, Trane Technologies, the HVAC company on pace, six straight positive month. KeyBank focused on commercial demand as summer approaches. You know what happens in summer? It gets hot. It gets hot, and you need air conditioning. So what do you say about Trane?
It does get hot. So Trane, this one is obviously its stock price is a little hot right now, but if you look at its growth expectations, it's massive. As you go into a summer and you look at the organic growth that they have been seeing as a company, very strong, stable margins, and you know, to add to the number of times you hear data center today, these Trane were their customers include data centers, they include schools, they include hospitals, so industrial centers. So this is a really, really inflexible segment of demand that needs to maintain cooling.
So can we just say Love Trane, the OJs? Remember that song? Great song. Love Trane. Get
yes,
on the Love Trane.
Absolutely.
All right. We're sticking with utilities here. Edison International, the final buy, shares down slightly so far this year. Guggenheim watching for a summer boost, but warning about payoffs for wildfire claims. You like Edison.
So we like Edison for a few reasons, not just because it has decent growth expectations and it is defensive. It's obviously a utility. It's defensive going into summer. It's a great time to be exposed. But also it has a really strong margin. Dividend at 4.4% yield. We own this in our dividend growth strategy. And, you know, it's not just about defending against inflation, but also if inflation is high, it means yields stay high. It means the Fed isn't going to come and bail the market out. So you're going to have stocks that pay good dividends to battle against the higher yields that are out there. So this is one of those.
All right, let's go for our bail now. A stock that everybody used to love, now not so much. It's Tesla, down more than 30% this year, despite a post-earnings surge this week. Canaccord calling it a very tumultuous start to the year as cost cuts, AI, and new launches all come into focus. How does inflation hurt Tesla here?
So inflation was actually a big component of why Tesla is disappointing. They effectively gave up on their mass market car that they were going to be building. And because of that, and partially because they couldn't make the economics work. So the inflation was just simply getting in the way of creating an affordable Tesla for the markets. And they're effectively ceding that entire market to cheaper EVs, like Chinese EVs. And that's a big deal. That's a disappointment for the outlook on Tesla. And a lot of the huge, huge valuation that you have behind Tesla is that they were going to continue to grow and continue to dominate. And so it really does put a dent in that expectation. So does it really deserve the massive valuation that it has been given, by Tesla files the world over? Well, that's being tested right now.
Now, so I guess we've heard a lot from Mr. From Elon and others about the robo taxi. Would you prefer to see them invest more in an affordable, cost competitive car than in a robo taxi? And I can only imagine how angry drivers in New York are going to be when they get behind a robo taxi that gets a little confused.
Yeah. So here's what I'll say, and I don't know that anybody's necessarily thought about this, but you know, when you think about costs of developing any kind of automated technology, the one that's used the most often is, quite frankly, when we fly. Autopilot is massively used and very safe, but it was extremely expensive. And I think that that expense has yet to be considered in terms of how much Tesla has to expend to make their technology safe.
All right. Thanks a lot, Gina. Have a great weekend. Gina Sanchez, Lido Advisors. That does it for The Exchange.
From pit lane to podium, the Las Vegas Grand Prix is providing fans a race day experience at the speed they deserve. With the help of T-Mobile for Business, our 5G advanced network solutions are powering race day operations with event-wide connectivity. From streamlined gate entry to an immersive app, giving fans blazing fast access to the sport they love. This is accelerating innovation. This is the Las Vegas Grand Prix with T-Mobile for Business. Take your business further at T-Mobile.com/now.